I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the truth about vaccines. You'll be hearing from Dr. Suzanne Humphreys. Are vaccines safe? Then from Ben Swan in Truth and Media, vaccine court and autism. Is it fair? Does it properly adjudicate vaccine injuries? Then we're going to look at Dr. Suzanne Humphreys on Gardasil. Then we're going to take a look at Japan leads the way, no vaccine mandates, no MMR vaccine. But to begin all that, we're going to first take a look at what we have written, Richard Gale and myself, on the specific subject of Gardasil. Why? Because Gardasil is probably right now the most problematic of all the vaccines, and yet it is the one that is being mandated in the state of New York, state of New Jersey, in Virginia and other states, California, Maine. And the likelihood is that if this is not challenged and stopped, that you're going to have an awful lot of vaccines with very toxic ingredients going into young girls' bodies and young boys as well, with no good science to substantiate why it should be done. Hence, the new article entitled America's Plague of Gardasil Injuries. It is posted on PRN.fm. Please share it with everyone you can. And it begins by looking at the history of the Gardasil vaccine, which illustrates clearly the concerning lack of oversight on the part of our health authorities when it comes to reviewing the pharmaceutical industry's testing of vaccines for efficacy and safety. Before receiving FDA approval, the HPV vaccine Gardasil was tested on fewer than 1,200 girls. Subsequent trials included many more participants. However, in the early trials, only 27% of the enrolled girls were actually administered the complete three vaccine series. Another remarkable misstep in the trials was that no girls under the age of 15 participated, despite the fact that the vast majority of girls given the vaccine today are under that age. Nevertheless, the vaccine was fast-tracked by the FDA in 2006. Rushing this vaccine through the regulatory hurdles is an example of gross negligence. 17 girls died before and after the trial. Nevertheless, without any compelling evidence, the CDC stated none of these deaths were due to the vaccine. In 2014, approximately 60% of all American girls and 42% of all American boys ages 13 to 17 received at least one HPV vaccine. Merck's shameful methodology during Gardasil's pre- and post-licensure trials was reviewed in a 2012 analysis by scientists at the University of British Columbia and published in the peer-reviewed journal Current Pharmacological Design. The research team did not mince words in their assessment of the flawed trials. Quote, "We carried out a systematic review of HPV vaccine pre- and post-licensure trials to assess the evidence of their effectiveness and safety. We found that HPV vaccine clinical trials design and data interpretation of both efficacy and safety outcomes were largely inadequate. Additionally, we note evidence of selective reporting of results from clinical trials, meaning the exclusion of vaccine efficacy figures related to study subgroups in which efficacy might be lower or even negative from peer-reviewed publications. Given this, the widespread optimism regarding HPV vaccines' long-term benefits appears to rest on a number of unproven assumptions, or such which are at odds with factual evidence, and significant misinterpretation of available data," end quote. Early doubts about the FDA's approval of Gardasil came from an unlikely source. Dr. Diane Harper, a consultant to Merck, the maker of the vaccine, and a chief scientist overseeing the clinical trials to evaluate Gardasil's safety and efficacy. After receiving FDA approval, Dr. Harper publicly questioned Gardasil's efficacy and public health value compared to the successes in preventing HPV infections from conventional pap smears. Among her concerns was that no data showed that Gardasil remains effective after 5 years. A truly effective HPV vaccine, on the other hand, would need to be efficacious for 15 years in order to prevent cervical cancer. And that, too, is misleading. The median age for early diagnosis of cervical cancer is age 50, and cervical cancer's median age of death is 58. And cervical cancer only represents less than 3% of all cancers and representing approximately 1/100th of the U.S. population. Yet, the CDC is targeting children who have negligible risk of cervical cancer. And now the vaccine is being administered to boys with zero risk of dying. After factoring for the profit boom Merck received from Gardasil, by the way, that's $2.3 billion every year, we believe the motive for the government forcing a vaccine that will have little efficacy in reducing of cervical cancer rates has little to do with public health. In addition, Dr. Harper estimated that every American 11-year-old girl would have to be vaccinated for the next 60 years in order to have any measurable effect on rates of cervical cancer. Gardasil's efficacy in protecting against HPV infection has also been criticized due to the fact that it originally only targeted 4 of the more than 100 HPV strains in circulation. In 2014, the FDA approved Gardasil 9, which supposedly protects against 9 strains. Scientists in the University of Texas presented research at a 2015 meeting of the American Association for Cancer Research, revealing that vaccinated women were at a significantly higher risk to become infected with HPV strains not contained in the vaccine when compared to unvaccinated women. Another study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association demonstrated the ineffective nature of Gardasil in women with existing HPV infections. The authors concluded that Gardasil offers no benefit to women recovering from HPV during a 12-month period. The research team stated that they see, quote, no reason to believe that there is therapeutic benefit of the vaccine elsewhere because the biologic effect of vaccination among already infected women is not expected to vary by population, end quote. In fact, a paper out of the University of California at Berkeley, appearing in the October 2013 issue of Molecular Cytogenetics, came to public attention last year to suggest that cervical cancer may not be caused by the human papillomavirus. If the theory proves correct, then HPV vaccines, such as Gardasil and Cervarix, do not prevent cervical cancer at all and are utterly useless. Given the high rate of recovery of people with HPV infections, the widespread use of the vaccine is highly suspect. Even the National Cancer Institute has stated that, quote, in most high-risk HPV infections occurred without any symptoms, go away within 1 to 2 years, and do not cause cancer, end quote. Remember what they just said, do not cause cancer. In fact, 90% of all cases of HPV disappear within 2 years. Cervical cancer is highly curable when detected early. The regular use of pap smears has helped decrease the incidence of cervical cancer in the United States by over 50% since the 1970s. Examining health data from Finland and the UK, Dr. Harper and her colleagues concluded that HPV vaccinations give a false sense of security to many young women and girls who in turn opt out of regular pap smear test. According to Dr. Harper, this trend has resulted in exponential increases in recent HPV rates. Even more alarming, Gardasil has gained notoriety as one of the most dangerous vaccines for its serious life-threatening adverse effects. The National Vaccine Information Center, a watchdog organization investigating vaccine injury, trends, and federal policies, reported, quote, after the original Gardasil vaccine was licensed for 11 to 12-year-old girls and young women, thousands of adverse reaction reports were filed for sudden collapse with unconsciousness within 24 hours, seizures, muscle pain, weakness, disabling fatigue, Guillain-Barré disease or syndrome, facial paralysis, brain inflammation, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, blood clots, premature ovarian failure, optic neuritis, multiple sclerosis, strokes, heart and other serious health problems, including death. Similar reports have been filed for the Gardasil 9 vaccine. As of May 2019, the Federal Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS, has received over 62,000 cases of adverse reactions from the HPV vaccine, including 503 deaths, over 6,200 hospitalizations, and over 3,000 disabling injuries. 47% of these vaccine injuries occurred in children and teens between 12 and 17 years of age. Despite the large number of injury and death claims associated with Gardasil and filed to the Federal Vaccine Injury Compensation Court, less than a third have been accepted and victims compensated for damages. Please keep in mind that as low as 1% of vaccine injuries are reported as high as 10%. That means that 62,000 adverse effects could easily be 90% more than that. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has undertaken a thorough investigation into the fraud found in the Merck trials that have led to the FDA approval of Gardasil and more recently Gardasil 9. Based on his calculations, 2.3% of girls in Merck's trials came down with autoimmune conditions within 7 months after receiving the full vaccine regimen. This percentage was the same for those girls receiving the aluminum-containing adjuvant as well. In other words, quote, women are 100 times more likely to suffer serious adverse effects from the Gardasil vaccine than they are to be protected from the cervical cancer, end quote. Dr. Stanley Plotkin, regarded as the godfather of vaccination, and author Plotkin's Vaccines, the Bible of the pro-vaccine industry, and described by Bill Gates as a, quote, indispensable guide to the enhancement of the well-being of our world, has often given testimony in vaccine injury hearings to argue for vaccine safety and against the evidence that vaccines are associated with autism and a variety of autoimmune diseases. During a 2018 deposition hearing, under oath, he stated the use of aluminum-containing placebos was, quote, a recognized control, end quote, and there's no credible evidence to suggest the adjuvant was contributing to severe autoimmune illnesses. His argument against the need to conduct longer trials to monitor the long-term health of vaccine recipients. The Gardasil trials, by the way, were only monitored for 14 days, was that there is no need, unlike drugs, individual vaccines are administered only intermittently and separated by a longer period of time. His argument for why no studies have been conducted or sponsored by the CDC that compares vaccinated with unvaccinated populations is because, quote, it would be considered malpractice not to vaccinate a child, end quote. Despite Plotkin's irrational statement, given that there are hundreds of thousands of completely unvaccinated children in the United States, a retrospective study is perfectly feasible. The Vaccine Data Link database, which the public does not have access to, already contains records for many thousands of people who are not vaccinated. Therefore, the data is already at our fingertips to conduct such a study, but federal officials refuse to permit it to commence. What are they afraid of? Last year, Italians took to the streets in a massive protest against the mandatory vaccination law. The independent Italian laboratory, Corvella, studied the contents in 7 vaccines, including Gardasil. The findings led to a national scandal that became known as VaccineGate, as ingredients were discovered to be quite different than that being reported to Italian health officials. Gardasil 9 was loaded with foreign bacterial DNA, an enormous 54% of the vaccine's total DNA, including human and mouse DNA. Out of 338 different contaminants found, only 22% could be identified. Although the vaccine is supposed to protect against 9 different HPV strains, only 7 antigen strains were found in the vaccine analyzed. Last year, the Journal of Toxicology and Environmental Health published a study conducted by Baruch College professor Gail DeLong that reviewed fertility rates in the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey database of 8 million American women. DeLong observed that a statistically significant decrease in childlessness for women between 25 and 29 years of age since 2007, a year after Gardasil was launched, until 2015. This was based upon a study in the British Medical Journal of a 16-year-old girl who was diagnosed with premature ovarian failure following HPV vaccines. A later study published in the British Medical Journal reviewing 12 Australian girls who came down with primary ovarian insufficiency, which leads to infertility, placed the blame on polysorbate 80 as one of the vaccine ingredients. In 2016, the American Academy of Pediatrics issued a warning about polysorbate 80 and premature ovarian failure. Gardasil contains 50 micrograms of the synthetic emulsifier, most commonly used in soaps and cosmetics. The Veris database also cites 48 autoimmune injuries associated with ovarian damage due to Gardasil. Other reproductive failures reported by Veris include spontaneous abortions, and amenorrhea, the absence of a menstrual periods, irregular menstruation. Her study concluded that 35% of vaccinated women could not get pregnant compared to 60% who did not receive Gardasil. Another study out of the Institute of Virology, Vaccines and Sera in Serbia reported by the Children's Health Defense Fund noted that the large amount of nano-aluminum adjuvant in the human papillomavirus Gardasil 9 has 1,500 micrograms, quote, contributes to, quote, hyperimmunization, end quote, that can lead to antiphospholipid syndrome and fertility impairment. DeLong's study came under enormous attack from pro-vaccine sources, including David Gorski from the Science-Based Medicine Network, with demands that the journal retraction. The study was finally retracted in December 2019. What is more important and being systematically ignored is that Merck never conducted fertility impact nor potential cancer etiology studies on Gardasil before its entry into the market. Furthermore, the push to mandate the HPV vaccine ignores the statistics in other nations that clearly show an increase in cervical cancer since the introduction of the vaccine. The vaccine was introduced in Australia and the UK in 2006 and 8, respectively. In both nations, cancer rates have increased substantially. Back in 2006, the Vaccine-Related Biological Products Advisory Committee warned that the vaccine might increase the risk of cervical lesions and cancer. That warning has come true. The VARBPAC group estimates that 44% greater likelihood of cervical lesions among Gardasil recipients. Efforts to legislate bills for implementing the HPV vaccine started almost immediately after the vaccine was approved, according to the University of Virginia study on history of HPV legislation. This included a large publicity campaign to make parents fearful of the risk of cervical cancer and the need for public financing. These attempts were made by the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, to get the vaccine admitted into states required where aluminum was going to be in the vaccines, and it was also in the schedule, meaning you had to get the vaccines or you couldn't go to school. Similarly, a Harvard investigation into Gardasil vaccine maker Merck's role in immunization policymaking uncovered that the company was in fact drafting the legislation to mandate the vaccine. It also made special efforts to target women legislators and physicians to assist in consumer marketing campaigns. Merck's lobbying activists in Washington have always been among the most aggressive on K Street. Virginia was one of the first states to enact a statewide school entry mandate for Gardasil. Yet 5 years later, a Medical University of South Carolina analysis found that the mandate had no impact whatsoever on overall compliance. In conclusion, today as more states are removing religious biased vaccine exemptions and mandating compliance to the CDC's vaccine schedule for all school children, including those attending private schools, we still are deeply worried and should be that efforts to include Gardasil in the mandated schedule will get passed in state legislative bodies, as we have seen this in one of the most poorly studied vaccines now being administered to tens of millions of boys and girls, adolescents, young women across the nation. It is one of the most dangerous and scientifically unsound experiments ever launched upon the American public en masse. Fortunately, efforts by groups such as Robert Kennedy's Children's Health Defense are proceeding to drag Merck into the courtroom for potential criminal activity behind Gardasil's research and reporting in order to get the vaccine fast-tracked. Given Gardasil's enormous health risks to children, it is incumbent for parents and individuals to educate themselves about the heinous deceptions behind this vaccine and support efforts to have it removed from the marketplace. We are 21 minutes into our program. We have a lot more to share. Dr. Susanna Humphreys and her take on Gardasil.
Okay, moment everyone's been waiting for, Gardasil.
All right.
Going through the Gardasil. The main reason that we're really passionate about this is because we're just, when we put a call out for interviews, Gardasil's just coming in thick and thin, and we're seeing horrific stories on young girls and boys of the most awful damage. Now, so I have here the Gardasil 9 insert, the actual real thing that comes out.
Yes.
First thing is glaringly obvious. Is there's a pair of scissors there with a line, and this is supposed to be given to every patient about to receive the Gardasil, and it's supposed to have gone, you, the healthcare provider, your doctor, your pediatrician, says, read this information with care with your patient. So that's really, really clear.
Sure,
so I haven't yet to meet anybody on any vaccine that's actually been given this little tear out bit here.
Right, and then the doctor is supposed to read this and understand the larger prescribing information.
The doctor's supposed to do that. And so clearly when you just glance through this, a couple of things stand out to me, and that is the side effects, which are the usual sort of swollen glands, joint pain, tiredness, chills, generally feeling unwell. But for me, big one as always, seizure. Yeah. Seizure is a side effect that's even written on the little summary here. So that's, in my brain, how common that is. Fainting. These are the things we're hearing about from many, many patients, the seizures. And the seizures aren't just a one-off seizure, they go on and on and on. So that stood out. And then, of course, down here, simple question, can I get Gardasil 9 with other vaccines? Gardasil 9 can be given at the same time as, and as a meningococcal vaccine, and the DTaP is what they say here on this piece of paper that comes. So no flu vaccine, none of the other things that we're hearing have been given at the same time. That is not recommended anywhere in the insert to be given at the same time as Gardasil 9.
That's what I have. And when I look at the, you know, this is just the printed out version of what you have because I can't see that little print. So I have the printed out version. And at the very end, it talks about how they did the studies with those two vaccines, and they found that they got a good antibody response from Gardasil even with giving those two. Now in this particular paragraph, it doesn't talk about safety, it just talks about immunogenicity.
So in summary, they don't really know.
I'm not recalling, it may be in here, but that's not something that I focused on when I read through the entire thing, was the safety while giving it with these other two vaccines.
The other thing that jumps out on my insert for me, well, nothing really jumps out because the writing is absolutely minute. But what does post-marketing experience actually mean? And what are they saying when they say that?
Well, so you have to understand how the clinical trials are designed in order to understand post-marketing experience, because I think that's important. When they are looking for volunteers for these studies, they have certain exclusion criteria. If you go onto clinicaltrials.gov and look at, you know, any, just pull up any study and you'll see that there are exclusion criteria. And they do this with babies as well. So say you are on an immunosuppressive medicine, or you have severe anemia, or you're being treated with corticosteroids, or, you know, some other kind of chronic medical problem, then you're not eligible to be in this trial. So in the end, what they have are fairly healthy people that they're trialing this vaccine on, and then they give it to everybody. And then, so the post-marketing experience is what happens after it's actually used regularly in the larger population and people reporting the adverse events.
So our children of today, could they be post-marketing experience?
That's right. And if you go, I recommend that people go to a website called SaneVax, SANEVAX. And there's a document there where they talk about the post-marketing experience, and they talk about the following adverse events have been spontaneously reported during post-approval use of Gardasil. And because these events reported voluntarily from a population of uncertain size, it's not possible to reliably estimate their frequency or establish a causal relationship. So this is what Gardasil is saying. So these are some of the post-marketing experience adverse events: blood and lymphatic system disorders, autoimmune hemolytic anemia, that's something you don't want to get.
Right.
Idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura, that's another thing you don't want to get. Lymphadenopathy, that's okay. Respiratory, thoracic, and medius. Pulmonary embolism, that's another one you really don't want to have. Nausea, okay. Pancreatitis, that's a baddie. Death, yeah.
I love that.
They put death in between chills and fatigue.
They sneak it in there.
Although there were deaths in the original trials, which we can talk about. Autoimmune diseases, anaphylactic, anaphylactoid reactions, acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, another baddie. Guillain-Barré syndrome, which pretty much happens with, you know, just about any vaccine. Motor neuron disease, paralysis, seizures, and transverse myelitis.
Transverse myelitis.
That was called polio in the 1960s. So these are some of the post-marketing experiences, and this is why we recommend that people, even, you know, if you're going to have your child or you're thinking about getting this vaccine, to at least just look down the package insert, go to SaneVax, read around a little bit, go to the CDC, read what the CDC has to say, read around the package insert, and, you know, develop some questions to ask your doctor. Or develop questions that you can go online and answer yourself, because whether or not someone wants to make fun of you for Googling, it is the largest library that's ever existed on the face of the earth. Okay, let's just go back. We have Gardasil, which had the four antigens, which was released in 2006. And because it was very successful at eliminating those antigens in people who were vaccinated, but what happened was, because nature hates a vacuum, is that other cancer-associated viruses cropped up in that empty space. And so now they said, okay, well, we have to expand. This is what happens. This is a common problem in vaccinology. So they had to expand the amount of antigens from 4 to 9 in order to compensate for that. So now we have a new Gardasil. So it's not Gardasil 1 and Gardasil 2. It's Gardasil is the old one, and Gardasil 9 is the new one. The other thing I want to point out is something that SaneVax outlines very nicely here, which is that normally when there's a new vaccine that's different, it has to go through an approval process with the FDA. And so what happened here in 2014 is that the FDA approved the use of a reportedly new improved version of Gardasil without consultation with the Vaccines and Related Biological Products Advisory Committee. And the reason for bypassing is that they said that the review of the information didn't raise any concerns or controversial issues which would have benefited from an advisory committee discussion. So it was very rapidly brought through the FDA without any rigorous scrutiny. And why this is alarming is because there are radical differences between Gardasil and Gardasil 9. And they're pointed out, for some reason this chart got duplicated on their website, and this is true, I checked it. So I'm not just going to SaneVax, I actually checked their information, and it's 100% true. So in Gardasil, there were 225 micrograms of aluminum per injection, 3 injections total. In Gardasil 9, there's 500.
That's right.
So that's more than double.
I flagged it. Hey, why would they do that?
Well, they have more antigens, and perhaps they want it to try to make it last longer in the body. They want to cause more of an inflammatory response. Your guess is as good as mine. So all the background substances, which are actually also very important, which we're going to get into in a while, because everyone, you know, they want us to think that L-histidine and polysorbate 80 and yeast protein are benign substances that we can inject, as much as you know, anybody wants with these vaccines, but it's not true. Now we always had the HPV6L1 protein, but they've increased the antigen from 20 micrograms to 30 micrograms. So that's a difference. That's a 1.5 times, right? So they kept this particular HPV11 the same. They increased the number 16 from 40 micrograms to 60 micrograms, and they increased the 18 from 20 micrograms to 40 micrograms, and then they added 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 new strains. So you tell me that this is the same vaccine that can be pushed through without, further scrutiny.
Have they done, is there anywhere that says they've done safety studies on the 9? other than
yes, I mean that's what this is about, and but
I mean other than rats.
What they're doing is they're basically doing what's always been done, which is to say, well, this was generally regarded as safe, so this is also going to be generally regarded as safe, just like aluminum. Phosphate is generally regarded as safe because all aluminum is generally regarded as safe. So now this new super aluminum called amorphous aluminum hydroxyphosphate sulfate, which is kind of a new, very scary, in my opinion, kind of aluminum, is also considered safe, although I can show you why it isn't safe. So they basically increase the total amount of antigen from 120 micrograms in Gardasil to 270 micrograms in Gardasil 9. They doubled the amount of aluminum. They have the same amount of injections, and they're giving this vaccine to people who have already had the original Gardasil.
Except it does say here that if you've had any kind of reaction to the first Gardasil, you must not have the Gardasil 9. So that's in the tiny, weensy writing in here that no one would ever
know.
That's very generous. It's very kind of them.
They also go over the serious adverse events here, and they compare Gardasil to Gardasil 9. And they make it look like, you know, this is directly taken out of this package insert here. So Gardasil had 2.5% of serious adverse events. Gardasil 9, 2.3% of serious adverse events. And you would think, well, that's not so terribly bad. But for every 100,000 people using Gardasil 9, there will be 2,300 serious adverse events. And this is the kicker, is that the cervical cancer diagnosis rate in the United States is 7.9 per 100,000. Basically, the risk-benefit ratio obviously should not favor giving this vaccine.
It makes no sense.
Given that it's a slow-growing cancer. Maybe we should review cervical cancer a little bit, because I did that. And I've done it. I have a video that I did in Sweden a couple years ago that people can go look at as well, which has more detail.
On YouTube,
on YouTube and on my channel. So, you know, cervical cancer is, you know, it's not all related to HPV. And there are studies that show that they can find tumors. It's less common than finding HPV, but it does happen. And we also find cervical cancer that doesn't have these particular strains that are in the vaccine. But in general, it's a slow-growing, slow-evolving change in the cell, which is called cervical intraepithelial neoplasia, CIN1, which isn't cancer. It's a change in the cell morphology or how the cells look, and it's not good. You don't want it. But the fact of the matter is, it is related to HPV, but it also is related to having low vitamin D levels, to smoking, to having multiple sexual partners. So there are other factors that actually you can change, improve your nutrition, improve your vitamin D level, stop smoking, that is proven to actually make a difference. But if we're just going to focus on HPV and CIN, what people need to know is that if you have CIN1, there are three stages of CIN. If you have CIN1, 70% of those regress, meaning go away, the HPV goes away, the change in the cells go away within 1 year. 90% of them will be gone in 2 years. Okay? CIN2, 50% of those will regress in 2 years, and many of them will regress as time goes on as well. CIN3, it takes longer to regress, and fewer of them regress. And then you can move on to carcinoma in situ, and then invasive cancer, where the cancer can grow into the walls of the vagina or up into the uterus, and so basically locally invasive. And again, there's no good such thing as a good cancer. But as far as cancers, this is not one that's going to take you overnight. And we've proven that the cancer is being caught so much more, 70% decrease in cancer since we've started doing pap smears and regular examinations. So I think that that's just important information for people to know. And the other thing is that we're recommending this vaccine for people between the ages of 9 and 26. And what we need to understand also is that the typical age of CIN, these changes, is 25 to 35, and that the antibodies, at best, are lasting 8 years. But in many cases, what I've reviewed in the bigger document is that for many of these strains, they're completely gone after 4 years. So we're vaccinating these young kids for a cancer that they're not going to have, more than likely, until they're 25 to 35. And by that time, the vaccine effect will be worn off. So I think that if there was a vaccine that was safe and effective, I wouldn't be giving it to people that are this young. But they think that if they get in there with the vaccine early, that they can prevent colonization with these HPVs, which is also absurd because we know that babies are born with these HPVs. We know that they can get them from the father. We know that tonsillectomies have them in the throats, and we know that they find them all over the body in humans at all different ages, including at birth. So the real problem with that is that if you already have a strain in your body of these cancer-associated HPVs and then you get the vaccine, you have what is called negative efficacy of the vaccine. It's a very undesirable situation because you can actually develop cancer as a result of getting the vaccine when you have the HPV in your body.
And that's hugely important.
Very, very important.
Nobody knows that. I mean, tell me why. What's their thinking behind the boys getting it then?
Well, gender equality, and also the fact that boys are carriers. And so if one boy has sex with one girl and then has sex with another girl, he can spread it from that girl to that girl. And he can also develop penile cancer, warts, anal cancer. If he's gay, he can be giving cancer and warts to his gay partners. And so they just think that they're using herd immunity as the reason, and they're actually showing studies that they are decreasing the amount of carriage of these HPV viruses in certain populations that are taking up the vaccine. That's all fine and dandy if it wasn't for the problem of original antigenic sin, where we've shown significant problems. And I've reviewed this, and I'll just show you some slides that demonstrate what I'm talking about. So this is the original Gardasil, okay? And so that was replaced by the new one, which has all these new strains and extra aluminium. Sorry, I gave that talk in Europe. And each series, again, is three shots. And what they found in this study by Guo, and I have a PMID number here, 2637-6014, is that HPV vaccination was effective against all four vaccine types in young women vaccinated after 12. However, vaccinated women had a higher prevalence of high-risk non-vaccine types, suggesting that they may benefit from newer vaccines covering additional types. So that's what I was just talking about, strain replacement. So we're seeing vaccinated and unvaccinated. So the blue lines here have some of the high risk non-vaccine types you see much higher than the unvaccinated. So that was a problem. So they said, okay, we've got it under control. We're going to create this new vaccine. So they gave it to people who had the old vaccine and to people who hadn't had the old vaccine. And the difference is also interesting. And this article by Chuck Rudar, in 2015, PMID 2604-6565, showed that if you had the old vaccine and you got the new one, your response rate was 25% among those who previously received Gardasil, but the response rate was 63% in people who received Gardasil 9 alone. And that's due to a term called original antigenic sin, also called linked epitope suppression, and it's very well defined. I mean, I didn't make this term up. This has been around since the 1950s, where the immune system responds according to its original training. So while it was trained to go after Gardasil original, it's still programmed in that way, so it's having an inferior response when you give it a new challenge with different strains. So this is a problem with the new vaccine giving to people with the old vaccine, in addition to the fact that it had what I am calling negative efficacy in the original trials. And I can show you that if you want to see that. So they basically did this this study where they used Gardasil and placebo, but we'll get into that it actually wasn't a placebo. Man, it's amazing how they define placebos. It took me so long to dig out what these placebos really were. But what they found was they gave the HPV with head strain 6, 11, 16, 18, and in these girls, the end point was developing CIN 2 or 3. That's the second or third stage of CIN. And they found that it had a negative efficacy, minus 44.6%. Well, that means that they were developing cancer at a much rapid, more CIN at a much more rapid rate than the girls who had had the placebo, which was either the background solution of the vaccine or amorphous aluminum hydroxyphosphate sulfate, not saline like it says in the FDA documents. And what's interesting is they kind of fob it off as saying these women were significantly more likely to develop high-grade markers for cervical cancer. And then the FDA says, they conclude that there is compelling evidence that the vaccine lacks therapeutic efficacy among women who have had prior exposure to HPV and have not cleared previous infection. So they're basically, in a sense, blaming the person. And the problem here is that if you were to go, say you're a 20-year-old and you go to the gynecologist and you get your exam and they offer you the HPV vaccine and you say, well, I'd really like to be tested for HPV first to see what strains I have, because if I already have the strains in the vaccine, I don't want that. Well, they're not going to be willing to do that for you beyond the normal HPV cervical testing that they do.
Why would they not be willing to do that?
Well, probably because it's too expensive. It's not recommended. I mean, the FDA and the CDC basically say, no, we shouldn't be doing baseline testing. Okay. So if you're going to give a 9-year-old, they're not going to test her for HPV beforehand, certainly.
So a 9-year-old of today in America and indeed around the world, are they the Gardasil 9 and what they will get if they go in?
Yes.
Is anyone using the old Gardasil vaccine now?
They didn't remove the old Gardasil from the shelves. This is also another interesting one. You know, that we just struck me this way today is that, you know, we're told that, you know, when there's a problem, we need to get a vaccine. And when it comes to Gardasil, they're saying, just give any vaccine. It doesn't matter. You can give Cervarix, which only covers 2 cancer strains. Or you can give Gardasil original, which covers 4 strains total, 2 cancer, 2 wart. Or you can give this new one. It doesn't matter. They say, just give something. No, that doesn't make any sense at all, because if the problems are these new strains that are cropping up, then everybody should be getting Gardasil 9. But that would mean taking all these new ones off the shelf and taking Cervarix off the shelf, which they should do, in my opinion, because it's made on caterpillar
ovaries. So you don't know what you're getting when you go in unless you ask.
That's right. Please ask, and please do your research before you accept it, because Polly and I have seen so much horrible vaccine injury. And I want to show you something when it comes to this horrible vaccine injury, that it's not just our imaginations, that this is a bit of an older slide, but what it shows you, and this again is from SaneVax, where they got the vaccine adverse event reporting system data. And so the blue bars here show the reports for all the other vaccines that are not HPV vaccines. And the maroon bars show you all the reports that were just for HPV vaccines. Now, if all things were equal, meaning the ratio of adverse events would be the same for HPV versus the other ones, we should see the maroon bars down here. But we see the HPV maroon bars up here. And in some cases, look at this, disabled. Look, it's like 1/3 higher amounts of disabled reports of HPV vaccine compared to all other vaccines combined. Look at this, infertility, look at that.
And that's what we're seeing.
Yes.
That's the main thing. I mean,
yeah. Abortions,
powerless.
Extended hospital stay. So in every case, it's higher than it should be proportionally.
It's a wicked vaccine.
And the problem is that when you get a vaccine injury with Gardasil, none of the doctors will recognize it. It's very rare that someone will recognize it as Gardasil related. So they're basically blindly stabbing in the dark, trying to treat you without acknowledging what actually hit you. So it's basically like being run over by the bus and being treated for a mosquito bite. You know, or even worse, being, you know, bitten by a snake and being treated for a heart attack, because they don't know what they're doing. They don't understand the pathophysiology, so they can't possibly treat it, even if they did acknowledge that it was from the vaccine. So this is a major problem. We're seeing girls that are type A personalities. That's what you're seeing, right? Hockey players, you know, cheerleaders, straight A students, you know, who are doing crushing everything, and all of a sudden they lay in the bed all day. The mother can offer them the credit card to go shopping and do anything that she wants, and she just says, no, I can't.
But that's
it.
Also showing signs of menopause, where the hot flashes everywhere.
That's
these
right.
are 15-year-old girls.
Well, the infertility rate is just, let's see, 78 compared to the rest of the vaccine reports, which is 22. So yes, there are definite hormonal issues that are going on there. And I also advise everybody to read an article by Dr. Daria Kanduk. And I know I mentioned her the other night, but she's written a lot of articles. And this one here in particular is on HPV 16L1 protein and sudden death associated antigens. And what she shows is that there's such similarity when you look at these antigens that are associated with sudden death, and she actually lists them all out. I mean, to read through this, please read this before agreeing to get a vaccine. Please bring this in and discuss it with your doctor and ask your doctor to allay your concern.
One of the main reasons I want to go through this is for the young girls are being told by the parents, because they've spoken to the doctor, that if they don't have this vaccine, they will develop cervical cancer. So you get this whole taunting of young girls saying, you didn't have that vaccine, have fun having cervical cancer.
Right.
So there's a whole, the education on this has gone skew-whiff.
Well, that's why people need to listen to what we're saying right now.
Okay.
Because 7.9 for 100,000 people, women in the United States, will have cervical cancer. So how does that translate to, if you don't take this vaccine, you'll end up with cervical cancer? It doesn't make any
sense at all. But it's usual bullying
right.
tactics.
Just like if you're signing your child's death certificate if you don't take this DTaP shot. Meanwhile, what did the doctor end up doing with Bryce and Carrie Bundy? The doctor signed the death certificate, right? Because that's who signs death certificates, is doctors, not parents.
That was Dr. Suzanne Humphreys on Gardasil. Now we're going to go to a segment by Ben Swan in Truth and Media about the vaccine court and autism to finish off our program.
The claims that autism is caused by vaccines have been completely disproven, right? We've all heard that claim, maybe most famously by actress and model Jenny McCarthy. But is the claim untrue? What if I told you that while HHS says there is no link between autism and vaccinations, the federal government has quietly awarded families of autistic children damages as a result of vaccine injuries? The first step toward truth is to be informed. The story we're talking about today is something that just doesn't get attention from mainstream media. And on the rare occasion when it does, the story is predictable. Scandals surrounding a doctor who claims autism and vaccines are linked. The bizarre parents who believe that their child has autism because of a vaccine, a claim clearly not based in science. But is there more to the story than what the media has told you? The real story behind vaccines begins in 1986. That's because it was in 86 when the U.S. Congress created the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act. Now that alone is worthy of a story, because what most Americans don't know is that a family who has a child injured by a vaccine cannot simply sue the vaccine maker. Under this 1986 law, Congress took that power away from families and instead created a vaccine court, if you will. So what is the vaccine court? It's a federal claims court that deals specifically with vaccine cases where families can go for injury compensation if their child is injured by a vaccine. The official name, Vaccine Injury Compensation Program, or VICP. Of course, this program is seen as necessary because, with rare exceptions, virtually every child who attends a preschool, daycare, or public or private school is required to be vaccinated, unless a family files for an exemption. So what's the problem? In 1986, when the VICP was first created, vaccine makers were protected from lawsuits by the public. The VICP insulates vaccine manufacturers from liability, and it requires the petitioners bring their petitions solely against HHS. They may not sue manufacturers or healthcare practitioners. The rationale for this industry and professional protection is to ensure a stable childhood vaccine supply and to keep prices affordable. The 1986 law also permits the vaccine makers the right to not disclose known risks to parents or guardians of those being vaccinated. Based on something called the Learned Intermediary Doctrine, manufacturers bear no liability for giving or failing to give accurate or complete information to those vaccinated. In exchange for being subject to the vaccine court, families of those injured would be compensated through an administrative process based on a table of presumptive vaccine injuries. At its outset, 90% of claims were on table. But almost 30 years later, things are very different today. The vaccine schedule, meaning the list of vaccines offered to children, has tripled. But the table of injuries has become much more restrictive, forcing 90% of petitioners into off-table litigation. Mark Blaxell is the father of an autistic child, a child who he believes has been injured by vaccines. Blaxell is part of a group called the Canary Party. It's a coalition of parents who are pushing for changes to the system through political means.
The Canary Party is a social movement that's created to stand up for the victims of medical injury, environmental toxins, industrial foods, the things that are causing these new health crises and epidemics that we're seeing.
Let's talk about the issue of the this vaccine injury compensation program, because most Americans, I would guess, have no idea this even exists.
Well, the thing that people should know about the vaccine injury compensation program is that it's unlike any other product liability circumstance that any of us deal with on a regular basis. In 1986, Congress passed a law that gave a blanket exemption to pharmaceutical companies from any liability at all for the injury that their products, in this case vaccines, would cause to consumers, and especially to children and infants. And what that did, that put in place a liability shield on the pharmaceutical industry, unlike the rest of the pharmaceutical product categories, so that if anything wrong happens to any recipient of a vaccine, what the family has to do is to, instead of just going to regular civil court with all this normal checks and balances and procedures and protections we see in the American legal system, they're forced to petition the government to recognize the injury to their child and to decide on whether or not they deserve any compensation.
So for parents like Blaxell, why does he believe the vaccine injury compensation program has failed? Well, that goes back to 2002. That's when nearly 5,000 families filed petitions with the VICP claiming that vaccines had caused their children's neurological disorder called autism. According to the Pace Law Review, in an unprecedented proceeding, the VICP created and conducted the Omnibus Autism Proceeding. It concluded in 2010. Well, that means instead of taking the cases one at a time, they consolidated the hearings for all these families. In the end, the VICP dismissed all the test case claims of vaccine-induced autism.
The original intent of the vaccine injury compensation program was to provide a no-fault, generous, rapid program of compensating injured victims. Now what we have is a cover-up and a situation in which the government is trying to say, you know, well, these things that the people say they observe, well, not only are we going to discount it, we'll actually approach it with prejudice. We're going to say that...
That this person is attempting to get over on the system. They're gaming the system.
They're gaming the system. They're trying to blame. They're trying to get money from the government. And that's just wrong.
But there is more. A review of compensated cases of vaccine-induced brain injury finds that the VICP has compensated approximately 2,500 claims of vaccine injury since the inception of the program in 1986. Well, get this. Since that time, despite the official ruling that there's no link between vaccines and autism, there have been 83 cases of autism among those compensated for vaccine-induced brain damage. So I guess the last thing I'd ask you is, in terms of outcomes, I mean, what you all were hoping for, because it's really a fight for other families. It's a fight for an entire generation of Americans, is it not?
Well, we're asking for justice because you have many, many injured children whose families are struggling, and they deserve support. We're asking for awareness of this crisis in our health system. We have the worst outcomes in the entire industrialized world here in America. We have the highest cost healthcare system, the most interventionist healthcare system in terms of medication and vaccination. We have a dramatic dysfunction, and so we need awareness of that, that we have a problem, and we need to shine a light on that. And then we need change. We need a fundamental renovation of our way of dealing with parental choice, with the rights of consumers, authority in the healthcare system, who gets to choose. And then we need to find ways to treat and heal all the injured children and now adults who are suffering from this system.
What you need to know is that on the Department of Health and Human Services website is this statement, quote, HHS has never concluded in any case that autism was caused by vaccination, end quote. Now, parents point out that while number and use of vaccines is skyrocketing, the number of autism cases is skyrocketing as well. But remember, correlation does not equal causation. Agencies like HHS will say that doctors and medical professionals, they're just better at recognizing autism than they used to be. And that may be true. But as one parent told me, while public statements have been made that there is no research supporting the assertion that vaccines can cause autism, families point to dozens of studies that do find a link between vaccines and autism that public health authorities do not share with the public, and that families would like to present in a civil court before a jury which they believe is their right under the Constitution.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know.